hand. Culture is the Soviet tank or the L.A. cop that guns him down. Civilization is the wild river. Culture, 592,000 tons of cement. Civilization flows. Culture thickens and coagulates, like tired, sick, stifled blood. In the morning, my visitor, whose name I didn't quite catch, crawled into his sack and went to sleep. I had to go to work. I went back to see him in the evening, but he was gone, leaving behind only a forged signature in the registration book, which wouldn't have fooled anybody. J. Prometheus Birdsong. He won't be back. But don't get discouraged, comrades. Christ failed, too. Now here comes another clown with a scheme for the Utopian National Park. Central Park National Park, Disneyland National Park. Look here, he says, what's the matter with you fellows? Let's get cracking with this dump. Your road is bad, pave it. Better yet, build a paved road to every corner of the park. Better yet, pave the whole damned place so any damn fool can drive anything anywhere. Is this a democracy or ain't it? Next, charge a good stiff admission fee. You can't let people in free. That leads to socialism and regimentation. Next, get rid of all these homely rangers in their Smokey the Bear suits. Hire a crew of pretty girls. Call them rangerettes. Let them sell the tickets and give the campfire talks. And advertise, for God's sake. Advertise. How do you expect to get people in here if you don't advertise? Next, these here arches. Light 'em up. Floodlight 'em. Turn on colored revolving lights. Jazz it up, man, it's dead. Light up the whole place all night long. Get on a 24-hour shift. Keep them coming, keep them moving. You got 200 million people out there waiting to see your product. Is this a free country or what the hell is it? Next, your campgrounds. You gotta do something about your campgrounds. They're a mess. People can't tell where to park their cars or which spot is whose. You gotta paint lines, numbers, mark out the campsites nice and neat. And they're still building fires on the ground with wood. Very messy, filthy, wasteful. Set up little grills on stilts, sell charcoal briquettes, better yet hook up with the gas line, install jets and burners. Better yet, do away with the campgrounds altogether. They only cause delay and congestion and administrative problems. These people want to see America. They're not going to see it sitting around a goddamned campfire. Take their money, give them the show, send them on their way. That's the way to run a business. I exaggerate. Slightly. Was he real or only a bad dream? Am I awake or sleeping? Will Tuesday never come? No wonder they call it Labor Day. The holiday is over, and a strange, sweet stillness, better than any music, soars above the arches. Gratefully, I empty the overflowing garbage cans, read the soggy old newspapers. We believe that the Constitution of the United States has finally expired. Collect the scattered beer cans and soda pop cans and burn them, along with the garbage and the dump. Hastens oxidation. The magpies and jays squawk among the pinon pines, which are heavy laden with clusters of light green, rosin-sticky, fresh, fat cones. We'll have a good crop of pine nuts this year. A variety of asters are blooming along the road and among the dunes. With yellow centers and vivid purple petals, the flowers stand out against their background of rock and coral-red sand with what I can only describe as an existential assertion of life. They are almost audible. Heidegger was wrong, as usual. Man is not the only living thing that exists. He might as well have taken a tip from a fellow countryman. Wovon man nicht sprechen kann, darüber muss man schweigen. Also the chemise, bright and stinking as rancid butter, and the mule-eared sunflowers, enjoying a great autumnal renaissance, and the wild buckwheat, the matchweed, the yellow borage, and on the mountain slopes, a league away, the preliminary golden dying of the aspens. Like a fire ignited in the spring, smoldering through the terrible summer, my desert world flares up briefly and brilliantly before the coming of cold and snow, the ashy winter, for the last time this season. Even the night has changed. Over a late campfire, kept going now for heat as well as liturgical requirements, I see new constellations dominating the sky. Instead of Draco, Lyra, Sagittarius, and vast Scorpio, a different group is moving in and taking over. Cassiopeia, the big W, symbolizing what? Who? In the year 1572, a temporary star appeared near this constellation, bright enough to be seen in full sunshine, throwing all the Christians of Europe into uproar. With good reason. They had much to be fearful of, the swine. Only 17 years earlier, they had burned alive Bishops Ridley and Latimer at Oxenford. A year later, Archbishop Cranmer and 277 other religious leaders were also burned, also in Merry England. Only 12 years earlier, they had hanged 1,200 Huguenots at Amboise. 10 years earlier, an unrecorded number were massacred at Vassy, followed by more religious wars culminating in the St. Bartholomew's Massacre of August 24, 1572. Something about transubstantiation, consubstantiation, and whether or not infants are damned at birth or not until later. Gloria in excelsis Deo. Now the high priests of nuclear physics dispute about the number of electrons that can rotate on the point of a pin. Where will this lead? But their disputes are peaceful. Only the bystanders get burned nowadays. Not far from Cassiopeia is Pegasus, for the Greeks a winged horse, to the Phoenicians the emblem of a ship. According to some astronomers, the major stars of this constellation are approaching us at an inconceivable speed. According to other astronomers, however, these same stars are receding from us at an inconceivable speed. Opinions on the matter are revised, exchanged, forgotten, and revived with comforting regularity, just as in the other hard or exact sciences. Linked to Pegasus by one star is Andromeda, the chained lady, low in the eastern sky. Within this constellation, visible to the naked eye, is a great nebula, the first to be discovered. Seen through my 7x50 binoculars, it is a splendid sight, a cloud of glory. And there is the water carrier, the sea goat, the ram, the whale, and last, least, and most obscure, Musca the fly, about halfway between Aries and the Pleiades, hard to see, scorned by the astrologers, neglected by all but me, a tiny group so far away that they may be already extinct, dead, extinguished, reminding us only by these last dim signals of their former existence. So much for the stars. Why, a man could lose his mind in those incomprehensible distances. Is there intelligent life on other worlds? Ask rather, is there intelligent life on Earth? There are mysteries enough right here in America, in Utah, in the canyons. Had a letter today. Bob Waterman is coming from Aspen with his beard, his Land Rover, and 150 feet of new nylon rope. We are finally going to have a look into the maze. Terra Incognita. Into the maze. Do we really need all that rope? I ask Waterman as he proudly and smugly coils his new nylon and stows it into his pack, along with slings, carabiners, brake bars, and other hardware. Who's going to carry it? I'll carry it, he says cheerfully, through a magnificent sandy beard. You can carry the water. But before we can explore the maze, we have to find out how to get to it. There's only one man in Moab who claims to have been there, a garage mechanic named Bundy. So we pay him a visit. Squatting on his heels, he draws us a map in the sand. Gas up at Green River, he says. It'll be your last chance. Take about 20 gallons extra. Go south 25 miles toward Hanksville. About a mile past Temple Junction, you'll see a little dirt road heading east. Take it. Keep going about 35-40 miles till you get to an old cabin. That's French Spring. Better fill your water cans there. Might be your last chance. Then south a few miles toward Land's End brings you out to the head of Flint Trail. Look it over careful before you try to go down. If you make it, head north 6 miles past a laterite butte to Big Water Spring. Should be water there, though this time of year you can't always be certain. Keep bearing north and east. 7 miles past Big Water Spring, you come to the Maze Overlook, and that's the end of the trail. From there on, you could use wings. We follow his instructions carefully, and they turn out to be as correct as they are precise. We camp the first night in the Green River Desert, just a few miles off the Hanksville Road, rise early and head east into the dawn, through the desert toward the Hidden River. Behind us, the pale fangs of the San Rafael Reef gleam in the early sunlight. Above them stands Temple Mountain, Uranium Country, Poison Springs Country, headwaters of the Dirty Devil. Around us, the Green River Desert rolls away to the north, south, and east. An absolutely treeless plain, not even a juniper in sight. Nothing but sand, black brush, prickly pear, a few sunflowers. Directly eastward, we can see the blue and hazy La Salle Mountains, only 60 miles away by line of sight, but twice that far by road, with nothing whatever to suggest the fantastic, complex, and impassable gulf that falls between here and there. The Colorado River and its tributary the Green, with their vast canyons and labyrinth of drainages, lie below the level of the plateau on which we are approaching them. Under the ledge, as they say in Moab. The scenery improves as we bounce onward over the winding, dusty road. Reddish sand dunes appear, dense growths of sunflowers cradled in their leeward crescents. More and more sunflowers, whole fields of them, acres and acres of gold. Perhaps we should call this the Sunflower Desert. We see a few bald-faced cows, pass a corral and windmill, meet a rancher coming out in his pickup truck. Nobody lives in this area, but it is utilized nevertheless. The rancher we saw probably has his home in Hanksville, or the little town of Green River. Halfway to the river, and the land begins to rise gradually, much like the approach to Grand Canyon from the south. What we are going to see is comparable, in fact, to the Grand Canyon. I write this with reluctance. In scale and grandeur, though not so clearly stratified or brilliantly colored. As the land rises, the vegetation becomes richer, for the desert almost luxuriant. Junipers appear, first as isolated individuals and then in stands, pinon pines loaded with cones, and vivid colonies of sunflowers, chamisa, golden beeweed, scarlet penstemon, skyrocket gilia, as we near 7,000 feet, purple asters, and a kind of yellow flax. Many of the junipers, the females, are covered with showers of light blue berries, that hard, bitter fruit with the flavor of gin. Between the flowered patches and the clumps of trees are meadows thick with gramma grass and shining Indian rice grass, and not a cow, horse, deer, or buffalo anywhere. "For God's sake, Bob," I'm thinking, "let's stop this machine, get out there, and eat some grass." But he grinds on in single-minded second gear, bound for Land's End and glory. Flocks of pinon jays fly off, sparrows dart before us, a red-tailed hawk soars overhead. We climb higher. The land begins to break away. We head a fork of Happy Canyon, pass close to the boxhead of Millard Canyon. A fork in the road, with one branch old, rocky, and seldom used, the other freshly bulldozed through the woods. No signs. We stop, consult our maps, and take the older road. The new one has probably been made by some oil exploration outfit. Again, the road brings us close to the brink of Millard Canyon, and here we see something like a little shrine mounted on a post. We stop. The wooden box contains a register book for visitors, brand new, with less than a dozen entries, put here by the BLM, Bureau of Land Management. "Keep the tourists out," some tourist from Salt Lake City has written. As fellow tourists, we heartily agree. On to French Spring, where we find two steel granaries and the old cabin, open and empty. On the wall inside is a large water-stained photograph in color of a naked woman. The cowboy's agony. We can't find the spring, but don't look very hard, since all of our water cans are still full. We drive south down a neck of the plateau between canyons dropping away vertically on either side. Through openings in the dwarf forest of pinon and juniper, we catch glimpses of hazy depths, spires, buttes, orange cliffs. A second fork presents itself in the road, and again we take the one to the left, the older one less traveled by, and come all at once to the big jump and the head of the Flint Trail. We stop, get out to reconnoiter. The Flint Trail is actually a jeep track, switchbacking down a talus slope, the only break in the sheer wall of the plateau for 100 sinuous miles. Originally a horse trail, it was enlarged to jeep size by the uranium hunters, who found nothing down below worth bringing up in trucks, and abandoned it. Now, after the recent rains, which were also responsible for the amazing growth of grass and flowers we have seen, we find the trail marvelously eroded, stripped of all vestiges of soil, trenched and gullied down to bare rock, in places more like a stairway than a road. Even if we can get the Land Rover down this thing, how can we ever get it back up again? But it doesn't occur to either of us to back away from the attempt. We are determined to get into the maze. Waterman has great confidence in his machine, and furthermore, as with anything enormously attractive, we are obsessed only with getting in. We can worry later about getting out. Munching pinon nuts fresh from the trees nearby, we fill the fuel tank and cache the empty jerry can, also a full one, in the bushes. Pine nuts are delicious. Sweeter than hazelnuts, but difficult to eat. You have to crack the shells in your teeth, and then, because they are smaller than peanut kernels, you have to separate the meat from the shell with your tongue. If one had to spend a winter in Frenchie's cabin, let us say, with nothing to eat but pinon nuts, it is an interesting question whether or not you could eat them fast enough to keep from starving to death. Have to ask the Indians about this. Glad to get out of the Land Rover and away from the gasoline fumes, I lead the way on foot down the Flint Trail, moving what rocks I can out of the path. Waterman follows with the vehicle in first gear, low range and four-wheel drive, creeping and lurching downward from rock to rock, in and out of the gutters, at a speed too slow to register on the speedometer. The descent is 4 miles long, in vertical distance about 2,000 feet. In places, the trail is so narrow that he has to scrape against the inside wall to get through. The curves are banked the wrong way, sliding toward the outer edge, and the turns at the end of each switchback are so tight that we must jockey the Land Rover back and forth to get it around them. But all goes well, and in an hour we arrive at the bottom. Here we pause for a while to rest and to inspect the fragments of low-grade, blackish, petrified wood scattered about the base of the butte. To the northeast we can see a little of the maze, a vermiculate area of pink and white rock beyond and below the ledge we are now on, and on this side of it a number of standing monoliths, Candlestick Spire, Lizard Rock, and others unnamed. Close to the river now, down in the true desert again, the heat begins to come through. We peel off our shirts before going on. 13 miles more to the end of the road. We proceed, following the dim tracks through a barren region of slab and sand, thinly populated with scattered junipers and the usual scrubby growth of prickly pear, yucca, and the alive but lifeless-looking blackbrush. The trail leads up and down hills, in and out of washes and along the spines of ridges, requiring four-wheel drive most of the way. After what seems like another hour, we see ahead the welcome sight of cottonwoods, leaves of green and gold shimmering down in a draw. We take a sidetrack toward them and discover the remains of an ancient corral, old fire pits, and a dozen tiny rivulets of water issuing from a thicket of tamarisk and willow on the canyon wall. This should be Big Water Spring. Although we still have plenty of water in the Land Rover, we are mighty glad to see it. In the shade of the big trees, whose leaves tinkle musically, like gold foil, above our heads, we eat lunch and fill our bellies with the cool, sweet water, and lie on our backs and sleep and dream. A few flies, the fluttering leaves, the trickle of water, give a fine edge and scoring to the deep background of silence? No, of stillness. Peace. I think of music, and of a musical analogy to what seems to me the unique spirit of desert places. Suppose, for example, that we can find a certain resemblance between the music of Bach and the sea, the music of Debussy and a forest glade, the music of Beethoven and, of course, great mountains. Then who has written of the desert? Mozart? Hardly the outdoor type, that fellow. Much too elegant, symmetrical, formerly perfect. Vivaldi, Corelli, Monteverdi? Cathedral interiors only. Fluid architecture. Jazz? The best of jazz, for all its virtues, cannot escape the limitations of its origin. It is indoor music, city music, distilled from the melancholy nightclubs and the marijuana smoke of dim, sad nighttime rooms. A joyless sound, for all its nervous energy. In the desert, I am reminded of something quite different. The bleak, thin-textured work of men like Berg, Schoenberg, Ernst Krennick, Webern, and the American Elliot Carter. Quite by accident, no doubt, although both Schoenberg and Krennick lived part of their lives in the Southwest, their music comes closer than any other I know to representing the apartness, the otherness, the strangeness of the desert. Like certain aspects of this music, the desert is also atonal, cruel, clear, inhuman, neither romantic nor classical, motionless and emotionless at one and the same time, another paradox, both agonized and deeply still. Like death? Perhaps. And perhaps that is why life nowhere appears so brave, so bright, so full of oracle and miracle as in the desert. Waterman has another problem. As with Newcomb down in Glen Canyon, what is this thing with beards? He doesn't want to go back. Or says he doesn't. Doesn't want to go back to Aspen. Where the draft board waits for him, Robert Waterman. It seems that the U.S. government... what country is that? Has got another war going somewhere, I forget exactly where, on another continent, as usual, and they want Waterman to go over there and fight for them. For it, I mean. When did a government ever consist of human beings? And Waterman doesn't want to go. He's afraid he might get killed. As any true patriot would, I urge him to hide down here under the ledge. Even offer to bring him supplies at regular times, and the news, and anything else he might need. He is tempted, but then remembers his girl. There's a girl back in Denver. I'll bring her too, I tell him. He decides to think it over. In the meantime, we refill the water bag, get back in the Land Rover, and drive on. 7 more miles, rough as a cob, around the crumbling base of a laterite butte, some hesitation and backtracking among alternate jeep trails, all of them dead ends, and we finally come out near sundown on the brink of things. Nothing beyond but nothingness. A veil, blue with remoteness, and below the edge, the northerly portion of the maze. We can see deep, narrow canyons down in there, branching out in all directions, and sandy floors with clumps of trees, oaks, cottonwoods. Dividing one canyon from the next are high, thin partitions of nude sandstone, smoothly sculptured and elaborately serpentine, colored in horizontal bands of gray, buff, rose, and maroon. The melted ice cream effect again. Neapolitan ice cream. On top of one of the walls stand 4 gigantic monoliths, dark red, angular and square-cornered, capped with remnants of the same hard white rock on which we have brought the Land Rover to a stop. Below these monuments and beyond them, the innumerable canyons extend into the base of a laterite mesa, which underlies a laterite butte, and into the south and southeast for as far as we can see. It is like a labyrinth indeed, a labyrinth with the roof removed. Very interesting. But first things first. Food. We build a little juniper fire and cook our supper. High wind blowing now, drives the sparks from our fire over the rim into the velvet abyss. We smoke good cheap cigars and watch the colors slowly change and fade upon the canyon walls, the 4 great monuments, the spires and buttes and mesas beyond. What shall we name those four unnamed formations standing erect above this end of the maze? From our vantage point, they are the most striking landmarks in the middle ground of the scene before us. We discuss the matter. In a far-fetched way, they resemble tombstones, or altars, or chimney stacks, or stone tablets set on end. The waning moon rises in the east, lagging far behind the vanished sun. Altars of the moon? That sounds grand and dramatic. But then why not tablets of the sun, equally so? How about tombs of Ishtar, Gilgamesh, Vishnu, Shiva the Destroyer? Why call them anything at all? Asks Waterman. Why not let them alone? And to that suggestion I instantly agree. Of course. Why name them? Vanity, vanity, nothing but vanity. The itch for naming things is almost as bad as the itch for possessing things. Let them and leave them alone. They'll survive for a few more thousand years, more or less, without any glorification from us. But at once another disturbing thought comes to mind. If we don't name them, somebody else surely will. Then, says Waterman, in effect, let the shame be on their heads. True, I agree. And yet Rilke said that things don't truly exist until the poet gives them names. Who is Rilke? He asks. Rainer Maria Rilke, I explain, was a German poet who lived off countesses. I thought so, he says. That explains it. Yes, I agree once more. Maybe it does. Still, we might properly consider the question strictly on its merits. If any, says Waterman. It has some, I insist. Through naming comes knowing. We grasp an object mentally by giving it a name. Hension, prehension, apprehension. And thus through language create a whole world corresponding to the other world out there. Or we trust that it corresponds. Or perhaps, like a German poet, we cease to care, becoming more concerned with the naming than with the things named. The former becomes more real than the latter. And so in the end, the world is lost again. No, the world remains. Those unique, particular, incorrigibly individual junipers and sandstone monoliths, and it is we who are lost. Again. Round and round through the endless labyrinth of thought, the maze. Amazing, says Waterman. Going to sleep. The old moon, like a worn and ancient coin, is still hanging in the west when I awake. All night long the wind has been blowing, haunting my dreams with intimations of disaster, and in the east, above the rim and mountains, are salmon-colored clouds whipped into long, sleek, fish-like shapes by the wind. Portents. Red skies at morning, sailors take warning. Northeast, the sky is vaguely overcast, a pallid gray. As I start a fire and prepare breakfast, the wind stops, suddenly, and the tremendous silence flows back, sealing the canyon country beneath a transparent dome of timelessness. The sun comes up, a resounding fire, the great golden gong of the dawn. Waterman stirs feebly in his bag. After breakfast, we get ready for the descent into the maze, the first, so far as we know, since the Indians left 7 centuries before, if they were here at all. Once again, Waterman checks the beautiful rope, all 150 feet of it, and his other climbing equipment, while I divide and pack our rations for the day. Raisins, shelled nuts, hard chocolate, cheese, dried beef, oranges, and water. The drop-off over the white rim is too far for our rope, but about a mile to the east we find a break in the cap rock where we can descend to the dark red stratum below. We are still nearly 1,000 feet above the actual floor of the maze. We traverse the red ledge in a westerly direction and find some notches through which we can climb down to the bulging, rounded, buff-colored rock of the Cutler Formation, principal material of the maze, and of the similar Needles area on the east side of the river. Here we find ourselves rimmed up 500 feet or so above the canyon floor. After further exploring, we find a good spot for a rappel, with a pinyon pine to serve as belay. The only trouble is that it is impossible to see from here whether or not there is a feasible route the rest of the way down. If further descent turns out to be impossible, then whoever goes down the rope first is going to be in a tough situation. The wall at this point is somewhat overhanging, requiring a free rappel of 40 to 50 feet. Easy enough going down, but cruel hard work to get back up. I don't know about Waterman, but am certain that I could never climb that far up a rope myself. Of course, there are various techniques for doing it, but none of them is easy. I invite Waterman to go first, he invites me, and we waste about 10 minutes in the Alphonse Gaston routine. He loses patience first, as I felt sure he would, gets into a sling, hooks up his carabiners, runs the doubled rope around a brake bar, backs over the edge, and slides out of sight. I crawl along a narrow shelf to one side and watch him free himself from the rope and disappear below among the crevices and boulders. Presently he comes back and tells me to come on down. He has found a way clear to the bottom. So it's my turn to dangle in midair. I've never made a free rappel before, and am a little nervous about it. As I lean back over the edge, I can't help but look down, and the sight of Waterman far below looking up at me is frankly kind of sickening. "What are you waiting for?" he wants to know. "Are you sure this rope is strong enough?" "It held me, didn't it?" "Yes, but I weigh more than you do." "Well, give it a try anyway." A very humorous fellow. But there's no honorable way out of this for me. After another minute of equivocation and technical inquiries, I lean back farther, keeping my eyes on the rope, and go down. Nothing to it. Half an hour later, we're down on the sandy floor of the canyon and inside the maze. We've brought the rope with us, of course, and therefore we'll have to find a different route up to the rim, if there is one. But that problem can be deferred for a while. If necessary, we've got enough food for 2 days. The air is hot, clear, dry, and our canteens nearly empty. We've taken 3 hours in the descent. The first thing we've got to do is find water. We start walking down the canyon. If we keep going, we will reach the Green River about 10 miles away, according to our map, just above its confluence with the Colorado. There may, of course, be obstacles. We don't know. Within half a mile, however, we find cottonwoods and shoals of damp, firm sand on the canyon floor. I dig a hole as big around as my fist and elbow deep and come to wet gravel. A few more inches and I find water. There is a stand of wild cane nearby. I cut 2 stalks, a fat one and a thin one, and punch the pith out of the joints of the bigger one by using the smaller as a ramrod. Happy now? Greatly relieved, I recall for Waterman's edification a few appropriate lines from Burns. "Green grow the rashes, oh, green grow the rashes, oh, the lasses they have cozy bores, the widows all have gashes, oh." Now we've got a siphon, 2 feet long. I offer it to the thirsty Waterman. He sticks it in the hole and drinks heartily. When he is finished, I take it, blow out the sand, and also drink. The water is warm, smelly, but potable and quite refreshing. Feeling much better, we sit in the shade of the trees and eat some lunch. I cut a few holes at odd intervals in the drinking straw, creating a sort of crude recorder, and play a few tunes in a barbarous scale never heard before this side of the Atlas Mountains. I stop, Waterman comes back and lies down for a siesta. I go exploring. At one place on the canyon wall I find 3 arches, or natural bridges, one above another, all 3 spanning the same drainage chute. Going farther up canyon I come to a fork, the first of many branches in the canyon system. The main or wider canyon turns to the left, revealing vistas of alluvium flats covered with sagebrush, more cottonwoods, more and more branching canyons with deep alcoves high in their walls, likely sites for Indian ruins. But I keep to the right, under the rim of the overlook where we had camped the night before, and scan the walls for a possible route to the top. I come after a time to a lovely pool in a basin of sand, fed by a trickle of water flowing down the canyon's rocky floor. I drink again, fill my canteen, and go on. This canyon, like all the others, forks again and again. I keep to the right-hand branch each time and finally arrive at a dead end, a box, with unscalable walls rising 300, 400, 500 feet straight up toward the hot blue sky. I go back to the pool and take a dip in the water. Lying on my back on the smooth sandstone beside the pool, I notice a finger-like ridge that juts into the canyon from the base of the main wall under the plateau above. If we can climb the ridge to the maroon bench above the cutler, we might be able to traverse laterally to the opening in the white rim through which we had originally descended. From here, it looks as if it might go. I'm just starting up to investigate the ridge when Waterman appears, tracking me up the canyon floor. He joins me, we climb the ridge together, and discover that it does indeed go all the way to the red ledge. There are a couple of tricky pitches with rotten rock and finger holds of exquisite delicacy, but most of the way is easy. We return to the bottom of the maze to get our packs and the rope and do a little more exploring, if possible. It is now late in the afternoon. We don't have much time left before sundown. Our sleeping bags are up on the rim in the Land Rover, and we have nothing to eat but nuts and raisins. We decide it best to climb out of the maze before dark and save further exploration for tomorrow. We go back to the pool and the base of the ridge. On the way, Waterman points out to me the petroglyph of a snake, which I had missed. The Indians had been here, but nobody else, so far as we can tell. Nowhere have we seen a trace of the white man, or of his horse or cow, or helicopter. But then we have seen only a tiny corner of the maze, maybe no more than 1% of it. The heart of it remains unknown. We climb the ridge, scale the bluffs, and traverse without difficulty the sloping red bench for a mile to the east, where we find the notch that leads to the top through the white rim rock. As we proceed, we mark our route with pointer stones. This will be known hereafter, for 1,000 years, as the Abbey Waterman Trail. Maybe. More likely, the BLM or the Park Service will bypass our trail with an electrical chairlift for crippled tourists. We reach the rim a little before sundown, and after a quick supper, for it's cold and windy up here, go early to bed. Above the orange cliffs, a dismal sunset of bloody sun and gray overcast lingers for a long time on the horizon, while the wind howls across our prostrate forms all night long. In the morning, the wind is still blowing. It's much colder, and the entire sky is dark with storm clouds threatening rain or possibly, judging by the chill in the air, even snow. It would not be the first time that a blizzard hit the high plateaus in mid-September. I try to wake up Waterman. Snow, I tell him, it's going to snow. He only curls up tighter in the sack. He doesn't want to go home. I build a big roaring fire, hang the coffee pot in the flames, dump a pound of bacon into the skillet, and stir briskly with a fork. The fierce wind fans the fire and chases sparks, coals, and shreds of juniper bark over the edge of the cliff 10 feet away. A dried-up tumbleweed comes over the rise from the north, dances past, and sails into space above the maze. Ecstasy and danger. We'll never get the Land Rover up those switchbacks if it storms. A few drops of rain sprinkle the sandstone at my feet and patter gently on Waterman in his bag. He makes no move. Breakfast, I tell him. Let's eat. He comes to life. As we eat, we discuss the situation. We each have another day to spare, but no more. I have to return to the Arches. He has to register for the fall term at Colorado University, far over on the eastern slope. If we get caught down in here by the storm, it may be a number of days before we can get out. And we don't have much food left. Of course, in an emergency, we could always descend again into the maze, hike down to the river, build a raft, float 50 miles down to height, and hitchhike a ride from there back to civilization, if anyone happened to be going that way. We agree, regretfully, to start back at once. It takes us only a few minutes to roll up our sacks and pile our gear into the vehicle. A light rain sizzling in the fire encourages our movements. Soon we are grinding back along the trail, four-wheel drive all the way to Big Water Spring, through the grand and beautiful desolation of the Middle Bench Country, above the inner canyons, under the ledge, where nothing grows but the sword-bladed yucca, the scattered clumps of blackbrush, and occasional stunted junipers. Next time I come this way, I think, and may it be soon, I'm going to bring a box full of Christmas tree decorations. Silver-blue tinsel, red candles, peppermint canes, silver bells, golden stars, and frosted baubles. And I'm going to pick out the loneliest, most forlorn of those little junipers and dress it in splendor, gay and glittering, and leave it there shining in the wilderness for a season or two, until the winds and the sun and the birds strip it bare again. We reach the foot of the Flint Trail. The storm is building up, the wind colder and harder than ever, but luckily for us, the heavy rain has not yet come down. Waterman shifts into low range. I get out and walk along behind to assist on the turns. There is no trouble. Getting up proves to be no harder than coming down, though we do find it necessary to add a little water to the radiator when we arrive on top. 7,000 feet up now, we put on jackets and hoods as a fine sleet drives down from the sky and turns the dust into mud. While Waterman pours more gasoline into the tank, I load my pockets with pinon nuts. Might need them yet. We go on, past the old cabin at French Spring, and through the woods and past the flowery meadows now gray beneath a mist of snow and rain. We stop at the BLM shrine to record our visit. "First descent into the maze," writes Waterman in the book, though he cannot be absolutely certain of this. And I write, "For God's sake, leave this country alone. Abby." To which Waterman adds, "For Abby's sake, leave this country alone. God." The air is thick with a million fluttering snowflakes. We hurry on through the 40 miles of desert, reach the paved road without getting stuck, and get back in Moab at dark, just in time for cocktails and dinner, while a great storm, first and biggest of the autumn season, blankets the high country with snow from Denver to Salt Lake City. Bedrock and paradox. The tourists have gone home, most of them. A few still rumble in and ramble around in their sand-pitted, dust-choked iron dinosaurs, but the great majority, answering a mystical summons, have returned to the smoky jungles and swamps of what we call, in wistful hope, American civilization. I can see them now in all their millions, jamming the freeways, glutting the streets, horns bellowing like wounded steers, hunting for a place to park. They have left me alone here in the wilderness, at the center of things, where all that is most significant takes place. Sunset and moonrise, moaning winds and stillness. Cloud transformations, the metamorphosis of sunlight, yellowing leaf, and the indolent soaring vulture. Who am I to pity the degradation and misery of my fellow citizens? I, too, must leave the canyon country, if only for a season, and rejoin for the winter that miscegenated misalliance of human and rodent called the rat race, Rattus urbanus. Today is my last day at the Arches. Tonight I take a plane for Denver, and from there a jet flight to New York. Of course I have my reasons, which reason knows nothing about. Reason is, and ought to be, as Hume said, the slave of the passions. He foresaw the whole thing. The old pickup truck will stay here. I've already jacked it up on blocks in a friend's backyard, drained the radiator and engine block, and covered the hood with a tarp to keep out the rain and dust. Everything is packed, all my camping gear stored away, even my whiskers shaved off. Bald-faced as a bank clerk, I stood in front of a mirror this morning and tried on my only white shirt, recently starched. Like putting on chainmail. I even knotted a tie around my neck and tightened it in the proper style, adjusting the garrote for fit. A grim business, returning to civilization. But duty calls. Yes, I hate it so much that I'm spending the best part of a paycheck on airplane tickets. Balance. That's the secret. Moderate extremism. The best of both worlds. Unlike Thoreau, who insisted on one world at a time, I am attempting to make the best of two. After 6 months in the desert, I am volunteering for a winter of frontline combat duty, caseworker, Public Welfare Department, in the howling streets of Megalomania, USA. Mostly for the sake of private and selfish concerns, truly, but also for reasons of a more general nature. After 26 weeks of sunlight and stars, wind and sky and golden sand, I want to hear once more the crackle of clamshells on the floor of the bar in the clam broth house in Hoboken. I long for a view of the jolly rosy faces on 42nd Street, and the cheerful throngs on the sidewalks of Atlantic Avenue. Enough of Land's End, Dead Horse Point, Tuckanickavots, and other high resolves. I want to see somebody jump out of a window or off a roof. I grow weary of nobody's company but my own. Let me hear the wit and wisdom of the subway crowds again, the cab driver's shrewd aphorisms, the genial chuckle of a Jersey City cop, the happy laughter of Greater New York's 1 million illegitimate children. If I'm serious, and I am, the desert has driven me crazy. Not that I mind. We get some strange ones out here. Last night, for example, came a fellow in suspenders and short leather breeches who spoke English with a Bavarian accent. A toolmaker in a Porsche on vacation from Munich, he carried a case of Löwenbräu under the hood of his car where the motor should have been. He spotted my campfire burning out back of the house trailer and invited himself over, along with his beer. I was glad enough to see him. He turned out to be a typical comical Nazi, his feelings still wounded by the fact that the United States had fought against instead of with Hitler. Americans, he said, are very much like Germans and should with them the dirty Russians together fight. Courteously, I declined the intended honor of the comparison. Not yet, I said. Not quite. We argued all night long. I defended the Americans, no one else was available, while he explained to me the positive aspects of anti-Semitism. Thus two monologues converged, near dawn, upon a murder. I could have opened his skull with a bottle of his own Löwenbräu, and was powerfully tempted. Maybe I would have done it too, but fatigue set in, and besides, I didn't have the heart. After all, he hadn't seen the Arches yet, or even the Grand Canyon. When he finally departed, my best wishes went with him. May his fan belt snap, his tires develop blisters, his fuel pump succumb to chronic vapor lock. May he never come back. October. Rabbit brush in full bloom. The tumbleweeds on the move, that longing to be elsewhere, elsewhere. Thousands of them rolling across the plains before the wind. Something like a yellow rash has broken out upon the mountainsides, the aspen forests in their autumn splendor. Sunsets each evening that test a man's credulity. Great gory improvisations in scarlet and gold that remind me of nothing so much as God's own celestial pizza pies. Followed inevitably by the night with its razzle-dazzle of stars in silver, emerald, and sapphire blue, the same old routine. For tonight, I prophesy a snowstorm. I feel it in the cold stillness of the air, the strange uncertainty of the sun, the unbroken mass of aluminum-gray clouds that hang all day above the north and east, an enormous lid soon to be shoved into place above the canyons and plateaus. The imminence of snow. In the government truck, I make a final tour of the park. East, past the balanced rock to Double Arch and the windows. Back again and north and east to Turnbow Cabin, and up the trail to Delicate Arch. Back again and northwest beyond the fiery furnace into the Devil's Garden, where I walk for the last time this year out the trail past Tunnel Arch, Pine Tree Arch, Landscape Arch, Partition Arch, Navajo Arch, and Wall Arch, all the way out to Double O Arch at the end of the path. My own, my children, mine by right of possession, possession by right of love, by divine right. I now surrender them all to the winds of winter and the snow and the starving deer and the pinyon jays and the emptiness and the silence unbroken by even a thought. In deep stillness, in a somber, solemn light, these beings stand, these fins of sandstone hollowed out by time, the juniper trees so shaggy, tough, and beautiful, the dead or dying pinon pines, the little shrubs of rabbit brush and black brush, the dried-up stalks of asters and sunflowers gone to seed, the black-rooted silver-blue sage. How difficult to imagine this place without a human presence. How necessary. I am almost prepared to believe that this sweet, virginal, primitive land will be grateful for my departure and the absence of the tourists. We'll breathe metaphorically a collective sigh of relief, like a whisper of wind, when we are all and finally gone, and the place and its creations can return to their ancient procedures, unobserved and undisturbed by the busy, anxious, brooding consciousness of man. Grateful for our departure? One more expression of human vanity. The finest quality of this stone, these plants and animals, this desert landscape, is the indifference manifest to our presence, our absence, our coming, our staying, or our going. Whether we live or die is a matter of absolutely no concern whatsoever to the desert. Let men in their madness blast every city on earth into black rubble and envelop the entire planet in a cloud of lethal gas, the canyons and hills, the springs and rocks will still be here, the sunlight will filter through, water will form, and warmth shall be upon the land. And after sufficient time, no matter how long, somewhere, living things will emerge and join and stand once again, this time perhaps to take a different and better course. I have seen the place called Trinity, in New Mexico, where our wise men exploded the first atomic bomb, and the heat of the blast fused sand into a greenish glass. Already the grass has returned, and the cactus and the mesquite. On this bedrock of animal faith I take my stand, close by the old road that leads eventually out of the Valley of Paradox. Yes, feet on earth, knock on wood, touch stone, good luck to all. Throughout the afternoon, the mountains are wrapped in a storm of clouds, a furious battleground. Tukanikovats has gone under, drowning in wild vapors, and a blue light covers the desert. In coat and hat and scarf and gloves and long underwear, freezing, I linger on my terrace near the Ramada, which is now being unroofed branch by branch in the winds, the red flag whipped to shreds, the wind bells jangling like a Chinese fire alarm. All of my old cedar posts and juniper logs have gone into one last magnificent bonfire, flaring like a transparent rose on the open rock, my signal to the world, unheeded. No matter, it's all one to me and the red dust of Utah. 560 tumbleweeds roll toward the horizon, herded by the wind. May they too never come back. All things are in motion, all is in process, nothing abides, nothing will ever change in this eternal moment. I'll be back before I'm fairly out of sight. Time to go. The trailer house is cleaned out, locked up, water lines drained, gas disconnected, windows shut tight, power plant under canvas. My own belongings are packed in the truck. The red bandana, the bells, I leave them here in place to wave and jingle all through the winter, unseen and unheard. More power to the both of them. All is ready for departure, and I see by my watch I've already put in 10 minutes of free overtime for the government. I had hoped to see the mountains in full glory, all covered with fresh snow before leaving, but it looks as if the storm will last all night. I had wished also to see the red rock of our 33,000-acre garden, the arches and buttes and pinnacles and balanced boulders, all lit up in evening light, but the sun, too, is buried in clouds. The fire is dying, the sparks scattering over the sand and stone. There is nothing to do but go. Now that all is finally ready, I am overtaken by the insane compulsion to be gone, to be elsewhere, to go, to go. Abruptly I cancel plans for a ceremonial farewell to the hoodoo rocks, and the lone juniper with its dead claw snagging the wind. I had planned a frivolous music. And turn away and hurry to the truck, get in, slam the door, drive off. When I reach Park headquarters near Moab, I telephone the airport and learn that nobody is flying from here to Denver tonight. The storm has ruled out all flights in the area. A new ranger, Bob Ferris, offers to drive me up to the town of Thompson, where I can catch a Western and Rio Grande night train to Denver. I accept, and, following a good dinner by his gracious wife, we load my baggage into his car and drive to the railway 30 miles north. No end of blessings from heaven and earth. As we climb up out of the Moab Valley and reach the high tableland stretching northward, traces of snow flying across the road, the sun emerges clear of the overcast, burning free on the very edge of the horizon. For a few minutes, the whole region, from the Canyon of the Colorado to the Book Cliffs, crag, mesa, turret, dome, canyon wall, plain, swale, and dune, glows with a vivid amber light against the darkness on the east. At the same time, I see a mountain peak rising clear of the clouds, old Tuckanickavats, fierce as the Matterhorn, snowy as Everest, invincible. Ferris, stop this car. Let's go back. But he only steps harder on the gas. No, he says, you've got a train to catch. He sees me craning my neck to stare backward. Don't worry, he adds. It'll all still be here next spring. The sun goes down. I face the road again. We light up our after-dinner cigars, keeping the flame alive. The car races forward through a world dissolving into snow and night. Yes, I agree. That's a good thought, and it better be so. Or by God, there might be trouble. The desert will still be here in the spring. And then comes another thought. When I return, will it be the same? Will I be the same? Will anything ever be quite the same again? If I return. This concludes Desert Solitaire. Please visit our website, www.tantor.com, for more information on our growing library of unabridged audiobooks and to take advantage of special offers. Or call toll-free 877-7-TANTOR to request a catalog.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.